Hello, my name is Leilani Gorm. For today's podcast episode, I will be interviewing Ms. Vanessa Avery, the first African-American woman to serve as the United States Attorney for the District of Connecticut. She's a native of New Haven, Connecticut, and attended New Haven Public Schools before receiving her undergraduate degree from Yale University. She received her legal education from Georgetown Law. She has extensive experience from her work as a litigation attorney in a private law firm and in her previous role as an assistant United States attorney in the Civil Division. Without further ado, we will talk with Ms. Vanessa Avery. This podcast is a project emanating from the Black Woman in Political Leadership class at Cornell University, taught by Professor Carol Boyce Davies, and we can just get started. So first, if you could just tell us who you are, your leadership story, and how did you come into leadership? I know that you're a native from New Haven, and you are the first African-American woman to serve as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Connecticut. So if you could just tell us a brief overview of how you got to this position.
Sure. Would you like me to start with a little bit of my personal story and then get into the professional? Okay.
That'd be great.
So I am, as you said, a native of New Haven. New Haven, Connecticut. I grew up in the heart of the inner city here. And I grew up during the 1980s and early 90s. So it was the height of the crack epidemic, the peak of gun violence here and around the country. And it was a time when law enforcement wasn't necessarily seen from the community perspective that I grew up in as a group of people we wanted to be friendly with. There were views in the community about whether or not law enforcement should be feared, whether they should be hated, whether they should be avoided. And I remember growing up and wanting to sort of have this objective viewpoint on that. And obviously now as an adult, I am a part of the law enforcement community. And I think it's been a great transformation experience for me to see this shift in my thinking and the thinking and those around me from this us versus them mentality to realizing that we are represented by law enforcement, and now to be a leader in the law enforcement community, that we are them, right? It's we, us, and our, not us and them. So my leadership story is really one that was born of my circumstances. I didn't think growing up that I was going to be an attorney or a leader in the legal community, let alone the law enforcement community, but I knew that I wanted to do something that would make a change in the circumstances that I saw growing up. And that's how I came to be here. I went on to college at Yale University, which is a very different part of New Haven from the neighborhood I grew up in, and then went on to Georgetown Law School, and then to practice here in Connecticut, where I've spent the last 23 plus years now practicing in the private sector, state government, and now federal government.
Thank you. Now, if you want to speak a little bit more growing professionally, how did you first start out in this career field and end up to, you know, this highly coveted position that you're in now?
Sure. So when I first graduated from law school, and let me back up, before I graduated from law school, I had the pleasure of doing some internships, summer programs during law school. And I highly recommend for anyone who's considering going to law school or any graduate degree program, or even if you're planning to just take your bachelor's degree and go out into the workforce, that you take some opportunities to do internships and externships and really get to try different things out. That was critical for me because, as I noted earlier, I didn't know any attorneys. So everything that I learned about law school and what it might be like was through those experiences. So as a law student, my first summer in law school, I actually spent the summer working in the legal services sector, working at the Yale Law School during the summer. Although I was a student at Georgetown Law School, I was able to work in Yale's clinical program during the summer. And that was a great experience, direct representation of parents who were looking to secure housing for themselves and their children, or benefits. And then also there was a trial going on that summer that I was able to observe on pretty much a daily basis, which was great learning experience for me when I later took the evidence course in law school. I had that practical experience to draw upon. And then my second summer of law school, I spent at a law firm. I had never set foot in a law firm prior to that interview season. Didn't know if it was something that I wanted to do or would enjoy, but I was encouraged by some of the upper class law students who were my mentors that to try it. Just try it for the summer and see if you like it. And I did, and I loved it. And it was the beginning of a great part of my career. I started my career after that summer at the same law firm here, based here in Connecticut, Cummings and Lockwood. And then after 4 years, decided that I wanted to try and get back to Washington, D.C., and ended up working for the Department of Justice in D.C. for a couple of years. And then after that, for personal reasons, decided to come back home to Connecticut and came back to private practice at the law firm, which at that point had merged with a different firm by the name of McCarter and English, which was based in New Jersey, but had offices up and down the East Coast, including Hartford, Connecticut. And then while I was there, I stayed there for 8.5 years and was able to get lots of experience doing everything from trials to appeals to affirmative and defensive cases, a little bit of everything on the civil side in terms of litigation. And I was fascinated by the challenge of that variety. And then the time came when I decided again that maybe there was something else out there outside of the firm setting that I might enjoy better. I think the public service call was just always there. There was something drawing me back to it. And so I ended up back at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I spent about 5 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office working in the Civil Division as an assistant United States Attorney here in Connecticut. And then after that, came to a point where a mentor of mine suggested that I consider applying for a position in leadership, which was at the Connecticut Attorney General's office. And that position was probably, it was one of my first formal leadership roles. It was certainly my first formal supervisory role. I had had a number of leadership roles in bar associations and things of that sort, which is really, I think, where I cut my teeth. And that sort of service perspective, serving on volunteer boards, serving on bar associations, dated all the way back to college, you know, campus organizations, serving as officers and lead and leadership roles on campus. So that was just something that always drew me. And when it was time to consider applying for this role at the Connecticut Attorney General's office, it called out to me again, decided to go for it, and I was fortunate enough to be appointed by the Connecticut Attorney General, Connecticut Attorney General William Tong, who's now in his second term with the Connecticut Attorney General's office. And I was in charge of all of our affirmative litigation for the state of Connecticut for 3.5 years. And did that until this opportunity came up, and had the great pleasure of being appointed by the President of the United States, Joe Biden, to serve as the United States Attorney.
Wow, what a great story. You made a lot of amazing points that I definitely want to circle back to, just having that representation and sort of abolishing, that us versus them dichotomy I see as being super important. You also touched upon the importance of internships and doing that while in school. I know for me, definitely, I did an internship in the office of the Chief State's Attorney, and that was a really great experience for me, sort of being on the other side, but still wanting to work within my own community.
No, and I would imagine that experience at the Chief State's Attorney's office was quite a rich one, from the chance of giving you that perspective, and also, as you said, to be able to see the community in a different light.
Right. And to get into my next question, which is more so on the personal side, how do you balance your personal life and professional life? And what is your advice to young girls today trying to figure out how they can balance their lives? I know for me, I'm a senior. I'm going to be entering the workforce soon. I'm also interested in law, but I'm going to be paralegaling before law school. So definitely work-life balance is something that I'm particularly worried about. So how do you do it?
Sure, that's a great question. And I will start by saying I usually refer to it as the ever elusive work-life balance. I don't know that there's one answer to how you do it. I remember before I started my own family, I would ask people that same question, how do you do it? You seem to have mastered, family, work and being successful at both. And no one had the same answer. I think the answer is you have to sort of figure it out as you go. I would say that if you are someone who really wants to have a family, to have a spouse and children, or spouse and or children, that you have to make sure that you make some time, carve out some time to be intentional about that, because it's very easy for those of us who are career driven to focus predominantly on the career side of the house. And so for myself, I knew that at some point I wanted to have a family as well. And so I made sure that I figured out what the right timing was for me. For some people that may be at a younger age, for some people that may be at an older age. And then for those who do decide to have children or have other dependents that they're caring for, you have to think about, well, how am I going to make this work? And that it could be daycare, it could be grandparents helping out, it could be a spouse who's a stay-at-home or has more flexibility. There could be a variety of situations you have that'll allow you to have the focus time on your career, especially at the beginning of your career. I think it's particularly important because that's when you're really learning your craft. That's when people will be able to and willing to take up the time to teach you the things that you need to know. So I would say those first 3 to 4 years are the critical time frame when you want to be able to focus on really learning your craft. There are no shortcuts. As far as the advice that I give, anyway, you have to put in the work, and the more work you put in up front, just like you're doing now in school, the easier it will be later to add on to that.
That's a great point, putting in the work from the jump up front. Has there ever been any instances where you had to explicitly choose between, your home life and your work responsibilities, or where you had to set more firm boundaries?
Yes. Yes and yes to probably yes to all of those. I think it's a constant, and sometimes there are going to be big conflicts, and sometimes there are minor conflicts. What I try to do, at least now that I've had some experience with managing these things, and even before when I was single, even before I had a spouse and kids, when you are trying to figure out where are your lines and your limitations going to be, if you have nieces and nephews, if you have parents or siblings or other people you want to visit, and also just personal time for yourself so that you can have that mental health balance and make sure that you are giving yourself those breaks. I think it's important for you to figure out where are the lines for me, right? And they have to fit within the expectations of your particular chosen employment. So, for an example, I think for most people, whether you're in the public sector or the private sector, when you're first starting out in your career, you need to be flexible in terms of the hours that you're working. You may have to work some weekends in order to get things done and to meet deadlines. You may have to work in the evenings. And so there are going to be times when people may invite you to go to a party or a function and you have to say no because you need to prioritize your work. But there are going to be other times where you may say, okay, I've been working hard for a 3 or 4 month period. I've scheduled some vacation time for me to go. I need to make sure that I set some limitations so that I can stick to that vacation schedule. That may mean if something emergent pops up that you have to do a little bit of work while you're away, but you have to make sure that you set those limitations for yourself in a way that helps you to continue to advance in your career. I'll just throw in reputation is everything in the legal profession and probably many other professions as well. And so you want to make sure that you keep that strong reputation. It's much easier to lose it than it is to keep it.
That's for sure true. And when you mention, setting these lines, and it's important to note that these lines are different for everyone from person to person. And as you mentioned, it depends, what type of job and what type of positions that you're seeking out. And of course, if you're in these high excelling, high leadership positions, sometimes that comes with the territory. But again, it's also good to preserve a level of mental health on top of it. So finding that, just right point, that balance is, it can be difficult, but it's possible.
Yes, it's definitely possible. I wouldn't be in the profession at this point if it wasn't possible. And I think you just have to, again, you'd have to use your judgment. You've done something right to this point in order to get to where you are. And for those who end up becoming attorneys, you have some judgment within you and some instincts. And don't be afraid to ask for advice of mentors and those who are around you as to whether it's appropriate for you to draw certain lines. But I think at a certain point, you will get comfortable and you'll know when it's okay to say, you know what, I can't take that call today, or I can't take on this additional project, and here's why, in a way that doesn't reflect on you. But I remember when I first started, there was a point when, I was just excited to have as many opportunities to do things as possible. And sometimes that meant that I had to stay late at the office, but it was an investment in the future of my career.
Do you feel there are any issues you are able to address better as a woman, or do you use gender lens ever when you're solving problems at work?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I've thought about it that much to really have a great answer for you.
Even your lived experiences as a Black woman and using like those intersecting identities, you can speak along that front too.
I will tell you that I think when you're really applying yourself to solving the problems that come up, and in this role, we're confronted with really serious problems, you want to bring your whole self to the table. And so for me, that means, the fact that I'm a woman, the fact that I'm a Black woman, the fact that I come from a certain community and a certain socioeconomic background, all of that factors into the perspectives that I bring. In addition to the fact that I, studied at certain schools that, are at the other end of that financial picture, if you will. And so I think everyone, when we talk about concepts like implicit bias and things of that sort, right? Everybody's bringing certain perceptions, certain perspectives to the table when they're trying to solve problems. So you want to have as many people as possible representing different perspectives as possible when you're trying to get to creative solutions. I think it's very important. Not all women, right? We're not a monolithic group. Not all women are going to think the same way. People use stereotypes like women are emotional, or men are a different way. I think you have to know the people in your office, the people in your space, and make sure that you have a mix of people at the table. We certainly have an office that is quite balanced in terms of men and women. And so I think often, as I'm just thinking off the top of my head, often our decisions are informed by both male and female perspectives. I think that's important. I know that that hasn't always been the case in our profession, and it's not always the case, especially in law enforcement and the legal field, because they're still, male dominated in a lot of ways, particularly in the leadership at the leadership levels. So I do think it's important to bring those perspectives to the table. I think it's also important for us to own each of our perspectives as a as an individual perspective, rather than always lumping together in groups, because my perspective as a woman may be very different from the person sitting across the table from me, who may also be a woman. But I do think there are particular issues that each person brings to the table from based on their background, and things that may jump out at me, as issues and concerns that other people may miss, and vice versa.
Bringing your whole self to the table, that's something that I definitely am going to take away from this conversation and listening to the perspectives of other, marginalized groups and other perspectives at the table is super critical as well. To bounce off of that, what is leadership in your thinking, and how would you define leadership, especially when women get more like in the political arena?
So I think leadership is just having, not just, leadership is a complex a term, and I think just to peel away from it a little bit, in some respects, I think leadership is having the courage to do what is right, to lead people in the right direction. Some people refer to the concept of being the adult in the room, right? When, as a leader, I see it as my responsibility to help to determine and, make final calls on, what are our priorities? What are we going to focus on? What policies are we going to implement and put in place? And then having the courage to move everybody toward that direction. Some of these things may be similar to what was done in the past before I moved into the role, and some of them may be new. And as we all know, change is hard for people. Leadership requires you to be steadfast and to keep people moving along and to help them to understand why they're moving in a certain direction, to help keep them incentivized to do that, to help explain what the anticipated outcomes are going to be, and to help to navigate any challenges that come up as people move.
Have your responsibilities shifted at all, working up the ranks?
So, yes, and I'm going to first answer the political piece by saying, I am in a political appointment position. I'm not in an
Right.
elected political position. And so there may be distinctions. I suspect there are very big distinctions between the two roles, but I will speak from my position as a political appointee. And I will say that, yes, in particular, going back to the point of showing up with your whole self. I see my job as all of the things that I just talked about in terms of leadership, but also there is a representative role for me. When I'm out in the community, how I'm presenting to people is important in terms of my affect as well as my actual appearance, decisions as to how and where I show up are important. Collaboration and community engagement is critical to me and critical to the work that my office is doing. But I have to think strategically about where it makes sense to show up and collaborate, and where are the spaces where I can prioritize my time because time is limited for all of us. As a woman, I want to make sure that I am showing up in spaces where maybe women haven't necessarily been historically, and making space for us in those places, even if that means that I walk into those places alone and look around and don't see a lot of people who look like me. I think it's important for people of all backgrounds to see someone who looks like me in this role. And so I'm very mindful of that, both in terms of my physical presence and in terms of electronic presence, social media, and things of that sort. I think it's important for us to show up in a way that helps to, blaze the trail for those who are coming behind us, for other women and other people of color to come and pursue roles like this, if not this one in particular. I think it's important for me to help to advance that possibility as well.
Serving as a role model, and when I did some of my research on you, I saw that you were sworn in at the high school in New Haven that you attended to really show people, you know, within your community, within the spaces that you have inhabited, that this is possible and it's not out of reach, which I found
Absolutely.
that very admirable. I'm from East Hartford. I went through East Hartford Public Schools. And I think it's really great that you're able to give back, you know, professionally, but also navigating the community space as well and showing up for your community. I think that's really great.
Thank you. Thank you. I think a lot of people underestimate and would be surprised at how much these seemingly small things can really make a big difference. You know, just people, you could change someone's life by just showing them what a woman, a young girl from East Hartford is doing now, right?
And you mentioned already some ways in which you lead, like you incentivize your team, you help them navigate, you help prioritize, you know, certain initiatives in the office. How would you describe your specific leadership style? You've also mentioned a lot your mentors. You refer to them a lot, you know,
Yes.
how they've guided you to certain opportunities and really, supported you and celebrated you. So if you could just speak a little bit more about how your leadership style operates.
Sure. Let me talk about leadership style first, and then I'll spend some time on mentors because I think that's critical as well. So, when people ask me to describe my leadership style, I think collaborative, I have been also labeled sometimes visionary. I like to try and use my creative side and to couple that with the logical problem solver that I've been since I was a little girl. I loved math. That was one of my first favorite subjects. And so I still consider myself very much a problem solver. You know, now I'm a community problem solver as opposed to mathematical. And bringing people together to help come up with the best solutions is something that I've seen be very powerful and impactful. And so that's what I like to do. I'm very team driven in the office, so I try to think very carefully about who the right people are to be on the senior leadership team, the management team in the office, as well as in other supervisory roles, and then to create leadership roles that may not necessarily be official supervisory roles within the office for those who are coming up behind them, because you know everybody can lead from whatever perch they have been given. You know, I've as I mentioned earlier, since college, I've been taking on leadership roles, and so I try to encourage people to think about where it is they think they can lead, and to pursue that within the confines of the goals that we're trying to reach. And as far as mentors, I have a variety of mentors, and I have been fortunate. Since law school and college before that, to always have been in institutions where they assign you formal mentors. And a lot of times, those formal mentors are not necessarily the ones who end up being your lifelong mentors, if you will. And so I guess I started to learn the value of mentorship early on in my academic career. And then professionally, I was assigned mentors from time to time, various instances, but most of my professional mentors are not people who were ever necessarily assigned as a mentor or given the label mentor. They were just people who I began to trust and go to for advice and direction and guidance on things. And I've just maintained those relationships. I have mentors from a variety of backgrounds, professionally, racially, and as far as gender. You know, my original mentors, if you will, most of them were men. Most of them were white males, because that's who the leaders were in the profession when I first started out. I now have probably about half men, half women who are sort of in my intimate circle of mentors and advisors. And as I said, a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds. For those people, I try to make sure sometimes I've had mentors who I worked with, in the same place of employment, and others who I knew from the community. But all people who knew me as an attorney, speaking of professional mentors, people who knew me knew what my capabilities were, who could speak to that, even if I wasn't in the room. They could be my sponsor. I don't know if you use the term sponsors versus mentors, but we like to say sponsors are the people who talk well about you and sing your praises when you're not in the room, and to other people. And so having those type of people around me, they have helped me to navigate every major career transition I've had, including into my current leadership role and the one before that, reaching out to them and asking them what they think about me applying for different roles, what they think some of my strengths might be in this regard, and whether they might be able to offer assistance, like giving me a mock interview, for instance, or looking over my resume or draft application papers. Those are all things that I think you should continue to do as far as, as long as you can and for as far as you can. They have benefited me.
So in my class, each week we focus on a Black woman leader historically. So we've learned about, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, Shirley Chisholm. Are there any Black woman leaders, historically that you specifically cite as a role model that you've looked up to and try to emulate, in how you lead within your office?
This is always a tricky question for me, because I always feel like I'm going to leave people out. But sure, I can cite some names. Most of the people who I really have tried to emulate are not people who are, famous historical figures. They're more people who are closer to me, either within my family or within my circles. But as for famous people, I would include Michelle Obama. I would include Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. I would include Constance Baker Motley, the late judge who hailed from New Haven, Connecticut, and served in New York. There are people like Maya Angelou. Her poetry and books were some of the first that I read as a young girl growing up in New Haven. I could probably think of on and on and on, including the ones you named, Harriet Tubman and Shirley Chisholm and Sojourner Truth. I mean, I love to read stories about people's lives, autobiographies, biographies. I think there's something that you can learn from just about anybody's story. We all have some commonalities. And even if we don't necessarily agree in terms of viewpoints, there are things that we can learn from people's lives, either that we want to emulate or that we want to be sure not to emulate. And yeah, there are so many examples of inspiration all around us. So that's a short list, and I'm sure I've missed lots of people. I should have mentioned, and this one just came to my mind, our vice president, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris, is also on that list. So,
Thank you for sharing and embracing commonalities. That's a very important theme, I think, as well. My next question is, how does women's leadership juxtapose with men's use of political power and power structures more generally? Have you had like any issues, dealing with, certain problems along the gender front within your workspace or your work environment?
That's a good question. And I am just shy of 1 year in the role. I will tell you that so far I have not encountered nothing is coming to the front of my mind anyway. I haven't encountered anything that I would say has been a challenge based on gender. I think part of that could be that I sort of, I am comfortable in this space because I've been operating in this space for quite some time. And so the gender dynamic issues that I describe, like, sometimes I'm the only woman in the room when meetings are occurring, or one of few. For some women, that can be extremely uncomfortable. For me, I've been dealing with that for 20 plus years. And so I think I've come to somehow find some comfort in the discomfort, if you will. I sometimes tell people you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Sometimes I don't really notice that, because if you focus more on the task at hand and getting it done, you realize that even for the men in the room, there are distinctions as between them and their perspectives and viewpoints. And so the perception that it's sort of all of the men against the woman is sometimes what I think gets in the way of us being able to be at our best, because we're creating this false distinction that should not be a hindrance to getting the work done.
More broadly, whether that, it doesn't have to be your own specific experience or something maybe that you've seen, do you feel that women in positions of power are scrutinized more heavily on issues such as competence, but also on issues like physical appearance, clothing, family? And if you have any specific examples of that?
You're challenging me on specific examples, but let me answer the first part of it. I do think there is a distinction between perceptions of women in leadership versus men, and I think the distinction comes from the fact that people are just not used to it yet. They're not comfortable with it. They haven't seen enough examples to understand that they can't judge all women the same, based on the experience they had with one. We're all different. We're all showing up differently, in the same way that men do. It's important, again, for us to understand, though, that for some people, they've been given a story about how women lead or how women think or show up in the professional world that may not be accurate. And they don't have enough experience with us in these roles to know that it's not accurate. So we have to show up and do the work so they can see it. People have often used the term representation matters, and I think it's important for me to be in this role because representation does matter for women and girls who look like me, but it's also important for the people who don't look like me to see me in this role to understand the importance of having women in these roles to see that I can do the work just as a male could do the work, and that I can make thoughtful and competent decisions in the same way that a male could. So I think women are scrutinized differently in some cases because people don't have experience with us in these roles. And I do think there are a lot of questions that are still open as to how we should show up in terms of our dress. Should we wear pantsuits? Should we wear skirts? Should we wear dresses? All of those questions are still lingering because historically there were rules that were strict rules for women as to what we had to wear. And some of those have fallen away in certain contexts, but for some people, they still exist. And so if you don't dress a certain way, then you can't fall into a certain bucket in their mind. And I think we have to, with more experience, challenge that. And the same thing with things like hairstyles. I'm looking at your hair and looking at mine, and those things we have the Crown Act in many places because of Black women and the desire to wear our hair in its natural state and to be seen as having a professional attire when we do so. That's still a challenge in a number of places, and I think we're fortunate that it's not a challenge here in Connecticut.
Yeah, and the Crown Act was just passed recently, in Connecticut, if I'm remembering correctly. That's progress there.
Yes. And and there are still, again, perceptions that people have, misperceptions about individuals who show up looking a certain way. And I think we have to just have the confidence to push through that and give it time to trickle down. And some of the pushback comes not just from, not just from men, not just from people who don't look like us, but sometimes from people who look like us too, who are used to playing by certain rules and think, you have to look this way and can only look this way in order for it to be professional. And so I think circling back to what we were talking about before in terms of leadership, part of the way I show up at work is so that I can create that space for those who come within this office and after me and around the state to know that, okay, I can show up a certain way and still be a professional, still be perceived as professional.
And thank you for working for that change in that space. Have you noticed any differences, relating back to the previous question from the corporate space, or more so corporate space? I know you mentioned that you were in multiple private firms, to the government side or the government sector.
There are definitely distinctions in private sector to public sector. And I would encourage you, if you have the opportunity, I know you said you were planning to become a paralegal first and then go to law school, but I encourage you to try and get some exposure to all the different settings. They're all different, and they're sometimes the d distinctions are subtle. Depending on where you work and the size of your law firm, some of them can be much more formal in terms of dress codes and things like that. But that can also be true sometimes in some of the smaller boutiques. And then at the same, by the same vein, a lot of places are transitioning to more business casual attire and, less formal attire, except when you have to go into the courtroom, of course. And I think the same is probably true in most government settings as well. Because in our office, and I know a lot of the other public sector offices here, people tend to be in court more. There's a little more formality in terms of the dress code because you have to be court ready. But for those whose caseloads don't bring them to court that much, they may have more flexibility to be a little more casual in the office, and those things. But the work itself, I think, everybody's looking for the same thing, right? You're going to learn in law school how to research and write and advocate orally. And so all of those skill sets are going to transcend all of those different settings. And at least I found that, again, the work that I put in those initial years, those early years when you're first graduating from law school and you have the attention of the people who want to teach you the ropes, if you will, teach you the tricks of the trade. Once you have that strong foundation, then you'll be able to more easily navigate the transitions between the different realms.
That makes a lot of sense. For my final question, it is a bit more forward-looking, but what advice can you give to the next generation of leaders?
Advice I would give to the next generation of
It's
leaders,
very broad.
yes. I would say, number one, don't be afraid to try new things. You want to, ideally, if you can find work, if you can find a career in an area that you are passionate about and also good at, just either naturally or because you've worked on it and now you have developed these skill sets. Then I think you're just going to be much happier, and the people around you will be happy to see you move into different leadership roles if that's the ultimate goal. I think you have to be start pushing yourself to, to get comfortable in settings that are not, that are somewhat foreign to you. There's people would always say, get outside your comfort zone. They would always say that to me. And I always found it a little bit annoying because being in a legal setting itself was, by definition, outside of my comfort zone, right? I didn't have any experience in that setting. So what did that really mean? But I what I learned, what I take away from that now that I'm in this role is the relationships that I have with people who were my peers. And some of whom were senior or junior to me, a lot of the strong relationships that I have now today are as a result of me going and pushing myself to be in settings where I wouldn't have otherwise known these people, right? Going to the networking events, the bar association events, programs and meetings like this in areas where I was interested, but where there might have been 50 people in the room and I didn't really know anybody, So you have to go and push yourself and introduce yourself and try and build those relationships. I see now, looking back, that the time that I invested doing those types of things was really valuable because it helped me to make those connections and to bridge those gaps and gain that new perspective that helps me to understand the complexities of issues and how to put together teams that are collaborative and include people with mixed backgrounds and viewpoints. That would be my parting advice, to push yourself to get outside of your comfort zone even more than you may think you are already, and to continue to do that as you go along in your career, to push yourself to grow.
Coming with, these lived experiences as a Black woman, and not necessarily seeing prior people that looked like us in these leadership positions, getting comfortable in those foreign settings is what sets us up to inhabit those spaces, I believe. And
Yes.
that's a really valuable point, in addition to your point about balancing your passions with your skill set and really just being confident from in to enter these spaces that we're not necessarily represented in heavily now.
Yes, you articulated that so well.
Thank you for taking, the time to meet with me. I really appreciate it. I know your schedule is probably so busy. So to hear back from you and to have this meeting really means a lot to me.
Well, thank you for reaching out. This means a lot to me too.